This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
All right. Good evening, Kansas City. It's John Kerman back in the host today to do the annual holiday show that I've done for the past, is this a 6 year, something like that, since we've had a holiday show ever since Eco Radio KC started. Normally we start our show with a news segment, but we don't have that for you this week. Should be back with a news segment next week, so we're going to jump right in to the main body of it. We will have an interview that Craig LeBeau, one of our regular hosts, did with Bill McKibben of 350.org when Bill was here back in September for his book tour and to speak at the Concert for the Climate at the end of the show. And I will also be giving you an update on our tar sands pipelines here in Missouri. But first, here we are, already 5 days into the official holiday shopping season for 2013. 5 days this year because more and more and more stores are opening to get our bucks on Thanksgiving Day. Sad to say, a lot of workers are being coerced into working on Thanksgiving Day, whether they'd rather be with their families or not. And, of course, Christmas decorations and Christmas this and Christmas that have been out for months in the store, so it's almost as if the holiday shopping season stretches all the way back to summer these days. But, of course, it didn't begin as the holiday shopping season. It began as the celebration of the holy day of Christmas. So tonight we're going to talk about how the holy day of Christmas and the 12 days leading up to it were turned into the holiday shopping season and what the consequences of that are, ecologically, of course, this being Eco Radio KC, but also for us emotionally. And as I've had for the last few years on, I have someone from the Center for a New American Dream to talk about that, but someone new this evening. My guest is Sarah Baird, who is the Director of Outreach and Communications for the Center for a New American Dream. Sarah, are you there?
I'm right here. Really excited to be here today.
Great. Thank you for joining me this evening, Sarah. I appreciate it. So here we are. It's a few days after Thanksgiving, this so-called holiday shopping season. But let's begin with a little background for folks who haven't heard me interview with the center, anyone with the center before. Tell us a little bit about the Center for a New American Dream and how you got started.
Sure. The Center for a New American Dream has been around since 1997, and it empowers Americans to improve their quality of life by really taking action to consume responsibly, protect the environment, and build a community. So those are kind of our three pillars. Historically, we focused quite a bit on making environmentally conscious or green sort of purchasing decisions or how to be a green consumer if you are going to consume or alternatives to that. But we really are trying to take things in sort of a broader direction now and figure out how we need to go beyond just consumerism or ownership if we're going to get remotely close to a world that lives within its resource limits. So we're working within three program areas, mainly redefining the dream, and that's to inspire and engage and challenge Americans to really reexamine their cultural values on consumption and consumerism, and really around what the good life and the American dream actually mean. And we do that through a lot of different areas, but one of those is a series called Living the Dream, where we talk to people who really are living a new American dream and simplifying and cutting back on things and sharing and focusing on more of what matters and less on stuff. Beyond consumerism is kind of our second pillar, and that's where we provide tools and support to families and citizens and neighborhoods to really counter the consumerist culture and build and create new social norms. And then finally, our last one is collaborative communities that really has taken off in the past year with our Get Together program, where we provide the tools and support to community members to create local initiatives and build capacity and leadership in their backyards to increase sustainability and foster livability and vitality for their neighborhoods and just right where they are. So kind of the think globally and act locally.
Right. So, I can't think of another organization that focuses so explicitly on consumerism. There are certainly other organizations that talk about consumerism as part of their broader work, but I do believe the Center for a New American Dream is the only one, well, at least the only one that doesn't also have a religious, specifically religious component of it. I think there's a... Oh, it's a simple living group that I can't remember the name of right now, but that does focus on this. So I don't want to assume that everyone out there in listener land already knows what we mean by consumerism. Usually a word that has that ism on the end of it is some sort of ideology or belief system. So why don't you talk a little bit about, well, what is consumerism exactly?
Sure. I mean, advertising really kind of invades our lives at this point, right, all the time. So it's hard to think about ourselves, you know, as consumers. But from childhood, which is super sad right now in America, children even and adults, you know, from the time we're born, we're thought of more as consumers than citizens. So we really want to challenge some of the messages about the American dream that are being sold by marketeers and kind of the wider consumer culture right now. And challenge that by saying, no, we should focus more on sharing, we should focus more on our community, and less on this consumer culture that kind of equates buying more and spending more money and having more things with greater happiness, which is just not true. You know, $19 billion is spent on advertising every year to tell us that story, but we're trying to really work hard to counter that story and those 3,000 messages a day we see from advertisers that are telling us that we are consumers and that consumerism and buying products and things is the way to happiness. So we're really trying to counter that.
Yeah, it is as if we're constantly pummeled with advertising everywhere we turn. And of course we can tune it out to some extent. We're so awash in it that we can't possibly pay attention to all of it, which of course is a big concern to companies that are doing their advertising, is they don't like the fact that we tune out some of it. But it seems to me that though we certainly don't buy everything we see advertised, that we have, as a society, really bought into this, the basic premise that almost all advertising is based on, which is this sort of notion that, well, one, we're not good enough the way we are, so it makes us dissatisfied, and two, that the way to make ourselves better, the way to make ourselves happier, is to buy whichever the particular thing that ad is selling. And that's an interesting, I've referred to it in the past as our economy being a perpetual dissatisfaction machine, because it no matter what we have now, it's not good enough, whether it's not the latest style or the latest technology or it's just not new, whatever, that it's never good enough, and therefore we're never good enough, because we're told to identify in this sometimes explicit but often implicit way to identify with the stuff that we have. Any thoughts about that, Sarah?
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I think that totally also ties in with the kind of we're overworked culture that we have today. You know, you have to work harder and work all the time, you know, in order to make enough money to buy all these things. And that's something we've also really tried to tackle recently with a new infographic series, where it's called The Overworked American, and you can find it on our website, newdream.org. But it really speaks to the fact that we are a society that focuses so heavily on being overworked so we can spend too much, you know, and that we will be perpetually dissatisfied unless we're working all the time to acquire things. So I think those two things really go hand in hand, and it's just, you know, we're really trying to fight that notion that you have to be acquiring and doing more and bigger and better all the time in order to be successful and be happy. Because it's just not true. I mean, you know, if you're going to spend money and if you're going to spend your time, you really need to spend it on experiences and spending time with your friends and family and those things that you actually remember, you know, emotionally and mentally and carry with you rather than a trinket, you know, especially during the holiday season.
Yeah, one of the things that I think of while you're talking is a study I read about, well, maybe a couple of years ago now, that concluded that spending money can make you happy. But the unexpected twist of the study was that the ways in which spending money made you happy was when you spent it on someone other than you. when you bought something for someone else or did something to help someone else, that made you happier, unlike just buying more stuff for yourself, which can certainly give you a jolt of pleasure, but of course pleasure and happiness are not the same thing. I want to take a little bit of a step back here. Of course, your organization's name is the Center for a New American Dream. Maybe it would be helpful if we try to articulate what the current American dream is, so we have a sort of context for what we're talking about.
Sure. I think you know, the current American dream for many is one that was defined by the things that we were just discussing, the kind of go-go-go attitude, the hurried sort of thing that somehow has become what people perceive the American dream to be, when reality for so many, what actually would bring them a sense of fulfillment and the kind of free and sort of liberated life to enjoy themselves that I think people imagine for us is one that focuses more on the things that matter, like spending time with family and community and things like that. And so much of the time, the things that actually makes a person happy and the things that people feel like they need to do to be happy are kind of in a juxtaposition, and the things that society rewards and promotes is the things that people need to be happy, such as more stuff and the latest gadget and, you know, working 90 hours a week at a job that you don't enjoy or not being creatively fulfilled and not being in touch with nature or being responsible about the environment. So I think that, you know, on the one hand, we have this sort of new, like, American dream that's been promoted for a while by commercialism and advertisers and marketeers who really want us to believe this one thing. But I think there really is an upswell, especially with the recession that's happened, of Americans who are embracing our new American dream that's about community and family and spending time with loved ones and the environment and nature and creating a really meaningful life where you contribute to community and society and value nature.
Right. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about while preparing for the show today was trying to think back, where did this current American dream come from? I'm reading a book right now by Charles C. Mann called 1493 that's all about how Columbus stumbling upon what are now the Americas transformed the world. And, of course, in the course of the book, they talk about some of the early English colonies in what is now the United States. And these were money-making enterprises. These folks showed up because they wanted to find a short route to Asia, so for trade with Asia to get rich, and they hoped to find gold and silver to get rich. And then when they turned out to not be able to find any gold and silver and the route to Asia was rather longer than they imagined, then they started growing tobacco, and that became a worldwide sensation, being addictive and all, so it was a big hit in Europe, so they started selling that, and it was about getting rich. So there's always been this a strong element in the culture of the United States, I think, of a sort of get-rich-quick mentality. But there wasn't always this consumerism mentality that we have now. That's really sort of I've read some of the history about it, and they started trying to push it back in at least the 20s. There's an interesting article that I happened across that appeared in a magazine called Nation's Business, written by an executive with General Motors. He was the general director of their research laboratories. And the title of the article really sums up what the business community decided they needed to do. And it was called Keep the Consumer Dissatisfied, because in essence they had more manufacturing capacity available with the Industrial Revolution and all the new supplies of fossil fuels. They had the manufacturing capacity to make far more stuff than Americans were buying, and they wanted to make more stuff so they could make more money. So they figured out that if you kept people dissatisfied with the way their lives were now, that you could get them to buy your stuff. So it was sort of a manufactured dream, this dream that we have now. Would you talk some? So we're talking. We've mostly talked about the effects on our community and our lives as individuals and our families of this consumerism. But of course, there are major ecological impacts to living a consumerist lifestyle too, which the U.S. led the way into. Would you talk about those?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. They're huge and gigantic, and something that if we just kind of, if everyone would just shift their kind of patterns of behavior a tiny bit, we'd be able to start countering. I think something that keeping people dissatisfied will keep them consuming, just like you were saying. And I think one way to kind of counter that is to start thinking about the sharing economy. I think that's one way that we're trying to start thinking about that, and from an environmental perspective and also a community perspective, the impact of sharing. And we have a really great guide to sharing and a video called Share Spray about how sharing really lowers your environmental impact, you know, and you're able to be a part of this larger, broader community and, you know, not have a huge carbon footprint. Because nobody actually needs, you know, if you have a blender and your neighbor needs it, to be able to loan that out is better than manufacturing and all the pollutants and the carbon footprint of transferring another blender or 12 blenders. But if, you know, and I think that something that's been super interesting is the rise of the sharing economy and this kind of new economy right now, especially post-recession, that people are saying, you know, look, I need to take a step back. I need to really evaluate how my lifestyle, how my consumerism and that sort of lifestyle is really harming the environment on a very personal level, you know, and it becomes less of a macro issue for the individual and more of a personal one. And I think through kind of sharing and these sort of simple steps and simplifying your holidays, of course, which we can talk about in a minute, you can take kind of concrete action towards becoming, you know, more environmentally friendly and respectful of nature, instead of just being this sort of consumer. And that can start with sharing, which and embracing the sharing economy, even if it's through maybe a tool library, you know, if you want to share tools, or a seed library, if you want to do that, things like that, that really focus in on building a better world from the ground up, literally.
Right. One of the other things that I was looking at in preparing for the show tonight was the latest edition of the Living Planet Report, which is put out by the World Wildlife Network. They put this report out every couple of years. The last one came out last year. And it's interesting. Every year they measure, well, there's a measurement they call biocapacity, which is basically the Earth's ability to support life. And they break it down by the Earth's ability to support each individual, and so it's to produce food and clean water and absorb our wastes and all of that. And then they do a calculation of ecological footprint by nation, so the average citizen of each nation, what their ecological footprint, what their demand on resources and ability to process wastes and all of that is. And it's pretty interesting stuff. As I was saying earlier, the U.S. led the way into the consumer way of life, although we certainly aren't the only ones who've embraced it. It's pretty interesting. Even the way we're living now, according to this calculation, and it's probably a conservative calculation, we are over-consuming what the Earth can provide. In order to provide for all the people the way we're living now, we actually need 1.5 Earths in order to sustain us. So we're running an ecological deficit. But to put in perspective the way we Americans live, if we were to try to sustain the entire world's population of 7.1 billion people the way the average American consumes, we'd need 4 planets, which obviously we only have one. So, and we're right up near the top as far as a national average ecological footprint. We're tied for 5th with Belgium behind the oil-rich Middle Eastern kingdoms of the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Bahrain, plus Denmark. I'm not sure why Denmark's up there so high, but we are one of the most consuming, and of course we also have one of the largest national populations, the third largest national populations, which means all of our 317 million Americans together consume a heck of a lot. But let's dig into how this ties into the holidays. So you have the Center for New American Dream that's very concerned with the impacts consumerism is having on us and the rest of the living world. Talk to us about how this plays into the holidays, and then we'll get into what we need to do, what we can do to change the way we celebrate the holidays.
Sure. I think something that you touched on a little bit, and Tim Jackson writes about this in one of his latest books, is that, you know, really people were kind of coming around to, you know, economists are kind of coming around to the thought that for our economy, it kind of needs to be in a steady state because it's limited by our environmental limits, which, you know, means our resources in the environment and not using all those up, as well as our economic limits, which means, you know, the debt people that have accrued and things like that. And I think that's something that really is resonating now, that we need to be in this steady state instead of just going and moving forward and accumulating and just always getting bigger and having more, which is primarily driven by, you know, consumerism and marketeers and people pushing that thing.
So Biden, just to clarify here, I'm not sure that necessarily it will be completely obvious to everyone what you mean by steady state, because we're given this assumption that for an economy to be healthy, it must grow. I mean, when economic news is reported, it's never a question of, well, the question is, did the economy grow or did it not grow? It's never, and if it grew, it's never a question of, well, was that a good thing? Was the growth that we experienced good? You're talking about something different.
Sure, yeah, and I think it's thinking about it as a mature economy instead of one that's growth at all costs. And usually when it's discussed, it's discussed more along the lines of, you know, we need to experience growth at all costs, and that's just not necessarily the case, as people have been pointing out lately in a lot of studies. It's better to be kind of in a steady state and mature and really thinking about our limits, our environmental limits and our economic limits, rather than, you know, kind of this driven, high energy, you know, consumption and consumerism way of thinking about our economy.
Yeah. Just real quick, if you have just tuned in, you are listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm your host this evening, John Kerman. My guest is Sarah Baird, who is the Director of Outreach and Communications for the Center for a New American Dream. And we're talking about consumerism and the holidays, which have become a miserable example of consumerism. So let's talk about the Simplify the Holidays program, Sarah.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think definitely the holidays are the worst example of you know, this in our society. And, you know, it's a time where people feel like, you know, excessive purchasing is really the way that they show that they care about other people, which is just not true at the end of the day. And there's so many ways to take that pressure off and relieve some of that stress as people really try to do it all during the holidays instead of focusing on what matters and retaining the meaning of the season and really focusing on friends and family and these kinds of activities. So, we have a lot of different components to our Simplify the Holidays campaign this year. One of those is really to just take our pledge, which is that you will do one of several different things during the holidays. One of those might be giving a gift of time. So you could create your own gift card for a service, whether it's babysitting or car washing or pet sitting or something like that. Offer to teach a skill you possess to someone else. Have a white elephant party, draw names in your family for gift giving so there are fewer gifts given, share the gift of music, give back to your community. That's a huge one this year. Tomorrow is actually Giving Tuesday. It's only been around a few years, but it offers itself up as kind of a national alternative to Black Friday and Cyber Monday and all that craziness, and we're really excited at New Dream to be a part of that this year. Giving Tuesday is a day devoted to and opting out of those days and instead giving back to your community, whether that's through a donation to a nonprofit organization, volunteering at a homeless shelter, even downloading our guide to sharing or signing up for our So Kind registry, which is a new registry we've created in the past couple of months for alternative gifts that focus on more fun, more family, more community, and less about stuff.
Well, I was going to say one of the tricky things about this is if you're the only one in your family who wants to make a change. Sometimes people will, if you say, well, I don't do the gift giving thing, they'll label you a Scrooge or a Grinch, which is really kind of laughable if you think about it, because of course the fundamental message of A Christmas Carol and How the Grinch Stole Christmas is that Christmas is not about all the stuff and even the decorations and things. Do you have any thoughts about how to approach this? If you're the first person in your family who's thinking that, you know, I really don't want to do this anymore?
Sure. I think that a really good place to start is by showing folks our Simplify the Holidays pledge, and because it offers so many ways. You're not opting out of giving gifts, right? You're just not giving a store-bought gift from a big box store. You're giving something a lot more meaningful. So I think present it like that. No one's not going to get a present. Everyone's going to continue to get the presents, you know, a present. It's just going to be one that's far more valuable. It's going to be a gift of time or experience or a second-hand gift or a handmade gift or something that's really, or you know, something that gives back to the community, making a donation in the name of a loved one. There will be a gift given. It just might not be traditional, and I think presenting it in that way and then really showing it in action. So, you know, it takes, you know, one little ripple to start a wave. So I think as soon as one family member is able to demonstrate how fantastic and rewarding and how good for not only the family but the community and the environment, giving an alternative gift and really focusing on simplifying the holidays can be, then everyone else will really be excited about following suit, because not only does it, you know, really help the environment and the community, it takes a lot of the pressure off of the holiday season, which focuses so much on kind of this pretense that everything should be perfect and everything should be beautiful and there have to be tons of decorations and you have to buy all sorts of things for people and boxes upon boxes underneath a Christmas tree, which just doesn't have to be.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mention it that way, because that's actually what I experienced in my family, which I announced years ago that I wasn't going to do the obligatory gift giving. I mean, there were Christmas Eves where I was out at the last minute before the mall closed, still trying to figure out what to buy my older brother, because I never knew what to get him. But I had to get him something, right? He had to have a present, whether I could think of anything that really made sense to get him or not. But what it turned out, in my family at least, was it was a relief to not have all this pressure to have a big pile of presents and all of the perfect Christmas. It has to be a perfect Christmas. So I agree with you that it's actually turned out to be a big relief if you can just get past the hurdle of beginning the conversation about it. You mentioned the pledge. What exactly does the pledge, by signing it, what exactly are you pledging to do?
You're pledging to do, we have about 15 different ways you can simplify your holidays, and you're just pledging to make an attempt to simplify your holidays in one of those ways. And then hopefully you're sharing it on social media so you can encourage your family members who might not have thought about this before, or your friends, or, you know, people who you work with, to also simplify their holidays and kind of rethink what the holidays should be about, which is more about spending time with those people, your friends, your family, your loved ones, and less about kind of a mountain of store-bought gifts. And I think one of the neatest things we have this year, we had it last year too, but we've redesigned it for this year. It's our coupon booklet. And basically with this booklet, you download pages and print them off, and then you're able to give family members a coupon for, you know, a skill. So, you know, if you're a really great cook and, you know, your sister is not so fantastic, you can give her a coupon to teach her how to cook one day, and she can call that in any time and use that. And so, you know, I hope with the pledge, when people sign it, they know that not only are they signing a pledge, they're really getting resources to help take actionable steps towards that, such as the coupon booklet, such as, you know, ways that they can do it and ideas about it, and also through our So Kind registry.
So where can people find those resources, the Simplify the Holiday booklet, the coupon book, and all of the other information you have for simplifying the holidays?
You can find it at our website. It's www.newdream.org. And for So Kind, you can log on to sokindregistry.org.
Okay. And I have to, one thing I want to make sure to inject here is just a reminder that this did start out as a celebration, a holy day of the birth of Jesus. And if anyone has actually paid attention while reading the Bible, it would be pretty obvious that the modern way in which Americans are celebrating Christmas bears no relation whatsoever to the teachings ascribed to Jesus in the Bible. So something to think about. Now, of course, not everyone who celebrates the holiday of Christmas is a practicing Christian, but still, I think it's important to keep in mind what this time of year started out, the Christmas time started out being about. So let's look some more at how our world would be different, how we would be living differently if we had this steady state economy instead of this growth economy. Well, let me take back and ask you the question that's inevitably going to be asked by anybody who is still assuming that we need to basically keep doing what we're already doing. Isn't growth good? Don't we need it? I mean, we have this world where so many people live in terrible poverty. Isn't economic growth the solution to poverty?
I think, you know, in America right now, something that has been, you know, shown time and time again over the course of studies that have come out, especially since the recession, that the recession has actually widened the gap between, you know, the haves and the have-nots, those who are living in states of poverty and those who actually are incredibly wealthy, the 1%. So, you know, instead of kind of bringing everyone back down to, back to, you know, in the middle class is becoming non-existent because of that. So I think, you know, so I think that would be my answer to begin with, that obviously on that front, growth is not happening in the way that we kind of, that one would think or that argument might be made. You know, I think that we really, the world that we would live in if we were in this kind of steady state would be one that was far more conscious of our local economy and really focusing on what's happening in our own backyard and making the quality of life for not only ourselves and our families, but our neighbors and, you know, our people down the street and our families and those people who are around us much better. And one way we've really, and supporting our small businesses and local businesses if we're going to shop and not really giving in to that commercialism and consumerism that drives big box stores and people to really, to shop at these just places that are a little bit soulless. So, I think that that would be something that our economy would look more like, have a global perspective, but really work within our local confines to make sure that we're supporting those entities. And we have a lot of ideas about how to do that in our guide to going local, which actually came out last fall. And, you know, from, you know, hosting an alternative gift fair to hosting a, you know, having a cash mob happen in your hometown at a local small business where people gather and come at one time and support this small business. There are lots of ideas about how to kind of make that a reality and start really going local.
Yeah. So one thing I'm thinking while you're talking here is that if we didn't have this focus on stuff, we wouldn't have to work so much because we wouldn't need all the money. I mean, what would we be doing with that money if we're not going to be buying more and more stuff with it all the time? And that reminds me of another article I read a few years back that appeared in Orion magazine called The Gospel of Consumption, written by Jeffrey Kaplan. I don't know if you've read that, Sarah, but it's pretty interesting. I'll put a link to it on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. You can go to Facebook and search for it there, listeners, if you want to check out the article. But one of the things Kaplan argued in that article was that not only did the business community set out to sort of invent consumerism and turn Americans into consumers when most of us had been conservers before, not only did they do it because they wanted to sell more stuff because they had all this excess manufacturing capacity, but they were also worried that the alternative of cutting people's work hours, of giving them shorter work weeks, would give them too much time to start questioning the sort of way society was set up, the way the economy was set up, the way the political system worked, that people might start getting more revolutionary ideas if they had too much free time on their hands. It was the first place I had ever read that possibility, that it was sort of seen as there being two options, that they could either manufacture more stuff or cut people's work week because the factories were so productive and they didn't need to be running all the time to produce as much stuff as Americans wanted to buy. And it was consciously decided that we'd better keep those factories humming and keep people working at least 40 hours a week so they wouldn't have too much time on their hands to start thinking about other things. It's an interesting thing to think about.
Do you think that
I'm just trying to visualize. This is the way our economy has worked my entire life. I'm 48 years old. I'm really trying to envision this sort of relocalized, and we absolutely need it. But it's interesting to try to picture what the transitional steps along the way would be. I don't know if there are any resources out there that you're aware of that sort of lay out a blueprint to how we move in that direction. Is there anything that you would recommend?
I mentioned these before, but I would really point you towards our infographics that we just put out on the benefits of a shorter work week and how actually Americans are super overworked, and the amount that they work really impacts not only every aspect of the environment and communities, but also their health. People who work 11 plus hours a day are 60% more likely to develop heart-related illnesses, 2.5 times more likely to develop depression, and almost 40% of Americans say that their job is very or extremely stressful. You know, this is in addition to the impact on the environment, which are, you know, if people worked 10% fewer hours a week, the carbon footprint would fall 15%. And if we worked 25 fewer hours a week, it would fall 37%. So those are kind of staggering statistics for, you know, for folks. And I think, you know, kind of knowledge is power in this situation. And, you know, the first step towards any sort of blueprint for change on how we relocalize and change the way our economy is structured. And there's a lot of movement in this area with the sharing economy and the New Economy Coalition, which is recently formed around this. But that, you know, everyone needs to be kind of armed with the real facts and not the ones that are fed to us by marketeers and people really pushing consumerism and consumption. And, you know, it's that, you know, we're less healthy, the environment's less healthy, our families and communities aren't very healthy. And just by cutting down on this, on the amount of time we work is a great first step towards relocalizing these economies and really invigorating and empowering, you know, people to become these community leaders who say, you know, it's time that we start reinvesting in ourselves and taking care of ourselves.
Yeah, and it seems to me that we're really going to have to band together to make this work, perhaps by strengthening the unions that already exist, perhaps through new mechanisms. I don't know, because it seems like a lot of employers would be reluctant to let people work fewer hours. And two, a lot of, you know, if your health care is tied to your employment, then if you go part-time, do you still have health care? And so there's these things that complicate one, even if one wants to cut one's work week, cut the hours that one works and step off the consumerism treadmill, that there's these obstacles to it that we're going to have to work together to change policies in government and to require corporations to make it possible to do this. There's a lot to think about here as far as the steps. I'm certainly on board that these are the things that we want to accomplish, but daunting to think about how one could do it alone, so I think we really have to band together to do it. We're just about out of time for this segment, Sarah. Do you want to give the contact information for the center again and just give us your final words?
Yeah, absolutely. We would love for you all to take the Simplify the Holidays pledge. You can find it at newdream.org. Also, check out our new alternative gift registry for all your Christmas alternative gift registering for gift of time and skill and things like that at sokindregistry.org. And if you need anything on any sort of front, feel free to email me. My email is sarah@newdream.org. I look forward to hearing from you all.
Great. Thanks so much for being my guest this evening, Sarah. Sarah Baird, the Director of Outreach and Communications with the Center for a New American Dream. Thank you, Sarah. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. If you've just tuned in, you are listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm your host this evening, filling in, John Kerman. And we have been talking about consumerism and the holidays and how the holidays have been consumed by consumerism. But now we're going to move on to a new subject. We're going to talk about tar sands pipelines again. We've been talking about tar sands pipelines on Eco Radio KC for a while now. The first time we mentioned what's called the Flanagan South pipeline was February of this year. So it's going on a year. We've already been talking about these things, and I wanted to give you an update on some of what the status of that is. So first, a little background in case there are folks out there who haven't heard any of the earlier shows. Flanagan South is a pipeline that the Enbridge Corporation, which is a massive pipeline company, oil and tar sands pipeline company and natural gas as well, I believe, wants to build. They're actually in the process of building from Flanagan, Illinois, which is pretty close to Chicago, to Cushing, Oklahoma. Now, of course, if you think about a map, in order to get a pipeline from Flanagan, Illinois to Cushing, Oklahoma, you got to go through Missouri and Kansas. And this pipeline, once it's built, is going to pass through 11 counties in Missouri and 7 counties in Kansas, including three counties here in the metro area, Bates and Cass in Missouri and Lynn in Kansas. Of course, those are in the far southern reaches of the metro area, but still, this thing's coming pretty close to where we live. It will also pass under the Missouri and Mississippi rivers, which is a consideration. Because what this thing is shipping is worse than oil. I mean, an oil spill is bad enough. If you have a major spill from a pipeline that's pumping oil and it gets into water, that's a disaster to be sure. But the thing about oil that makes it relatively easy to clean up is oil floats. Oil and water don't mix. Crude oil floats on the surface of the water, which enables you to skim most of it, to use booms to collect it. Collects relatively easily. But what will be pumped through this Flanagan South pipeline once it's completed is a substance the industry calls dilbit. They like shorthand. Dilbit is short for diluted bitumen. And bitumen is what is produced in the tar sands in Alberta, Canada. It's a thick, tarry substance. The consistency of raw bitumen is basically that similar to that of peanut butter. Well, they dilute it in order to pump it through a pipeline. Obviously, it would be pretty hard to pump peanut butter through a pipeline. So they put a diluting agent in it. I believe it's about 30% diluting agent in the mix of dilbit. And they use natural gas condensates to do that. But when dilbit spills into water, what happens is it floats briefly. And then these diluting agents evaporate. They vaporize and go into the atmosphere, and what you're left with is the bitumen that, again, has the consistency of peanut butter. Of course, peanut butter doesn't float, so the bitumen sinks to the bottom, which makes it a lot harder to clean up, of course. What would have been a skimming job off of the surface of the water in an oil spill is now a dredging job. And we have ample evidence of just how devastating such a spill into a river could be. Back in July of 2010, a different Enbridge pipeline, not a new pipeline, an old pipeline called Line 6B, ruptured and spilled for 18 hours before it was shut off into a tributary of the Kalamazoo River. Well, some of that bitumen is still on the bottom of the Kalamazoo River, from what I understand. The EPA ordered Enbridge earlier this year to dredge the river again. If I remember right, they've spent about $1 billion on that cleanup of the spill into the Kalamazoo River, and it's not yet cleaned up. Now, as far as spills, of course, a new pipeline shouldn't spill, at least not very often and not in very large quantities. But one of the interesting things about this Flanagan South pipeline is that it's an expansion of capacity on this route from Flanagan, Illinois to Cushing, Oklahoma. There's an old pipeline, about a 50-year-old pipeline that's already in along that route that the Flanagan South will mostly parallel. It's a pipeline called Spearhead that Enbridge bought controlling interest in several years ago, and then they reversed the flow of the pipeline. It was originally built to pump crude oil from Cushing to Flanagan, Illinois, so they reversed the flow to pump the opposite direction, and they increased the capacity, which is really worrisome. So this Spearhead pipeline now has a capacity of nearly 200,000 barrels per day, being pumped in the opposite direction. A different substance, dilbit, rather than crude oil, is being pumped through it, different substance than what it was engineered to handle. This dilbit is more corrosive than regular light sweet crude oil. It also, because it's more corrosive, runs hotter through the pipelines. All of this, reversing the flow, the more corrosive nature, the hotter temperature, all put greater stress on pipelines. That Spearhead pipeline is probably the much bigger risk of a spill anytime soon because of those factors. And we kind of know already what's likely to happen. ExxonMobil had a spill in Mayflower, Arkansas earlier this year. It was described as an oil spill in the media, but it was in fact a dilbit spill. Anyway, so this Flanagan South pipeline was permitted by the Army Corps of Engineers using this thing called a Nationwide Permit 12, which is really it's a way of avoiding doing a complete environmental assessment. The Sierra Club and the National Wildlife Federation sued the Army Corps of Engineers, the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Department of Interior Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the EPA for not doing a complete environmental assessment of the Flanagan South Pipeline on the justification that this violated the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Administrative Procedure Act. And they called for a preliminary injunction to stop pipeline construction, but just a couple of weeks ago, I think now it was, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson of the U.S. District Court in District of Columbia turned down that order for a preliminary, or that request for a preliminary injunction. And the grounds basically were that in their lawsuit, the Sierra Club and the National Wildlife Federation didn't sufficiently prove that irreparable harm would be caused if pipeline construction was allowed to continue. And then what is called the balance of harm weighed in favor of Enbridge, the company that wants to build it. In essence, they argued that Enbridge's sort of divine right to engage in profit-making activity outweighed any harm that would come from the pipeline, so that it couldn't be justified to have put an injunction in place that would halt construction of the pipeline while the lawsuit moved forward. So it's interesting. The fight on that is not over. I'm sure we'll report on it again. But now we need to wrap up this segment and go to Craig LeBeau's interview with Bill McKibben of 350.org, recorded in September.
I'm here with Bill McKibben. Bill is my next guest. Bill is the founder of 350.org, and he recently has a new book released called Oil and Honey. And welcome, Bill.
Hello there. How are you?
Excellent. Good. First question we've got is, can you just tell us a little bit of what 350.org is?
Well, 350.org is the first big global climate campaign. It takes its odd name from what scientists tell us is the most carbon we could safely have in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million, a number, as you know, that we're already now well past. We went past 400 this spring, going up about 2 parts per million per year. That's why the Arctic is melting and the ocean is acidifying. That's why we have such strange weather out across the middle of the country these days. So 350 in a way is it's a little depressing as a name in a way, but it's also very realistic. And it's allowed us, in part because Arabic numerals translate across linguistic boundaries, to organize around the world. We've organized about 15,000 demonstrations in every country on Earth except North Korea.
What are the health and environmental implications of the warming trend?
Well, this is by far the biggest thing that human beings have ever done. The one sort of big study on health effects of climate indicates that at the moment we're losing about 300,000 lives a year, and that by 2030 the total lives lost to fossil fuel will be on the order of 100 million. But the sort of real message is we're destabilizing the Earth and all its systems, and throwing everything that we've taken for granted for the last 10,000 years, the policy, into real question.
I know there's an international agency that just released a report, I guess it was this week. Are there any, first of all, did you have a chance to look at
it? Oh, yes. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this is their fifth report. They do one every 6 years. They've been very important landmarks in the fight on climate change. And they, this one made it, they said our confidence is even higher, that it's very clear that the warming we see around the world is caused by human beings, and that it is a grave danger. And they said we need to leave most of the coal and gas and oil that we know about in the ground. That's just the way it is.
And what type of panel is it that comes out with that report?
It's a panel put together originally by the UN of the world's climatologists, climate scientists. And it's thousands of scientists, and they review all the peer-reviewed literature that's emerged in the last half decade since their most recent report.
And I also saw an article that we're approaching the point where the damage may last several centuries.
Oh, it'll last, I'm afraid, much longer than that. The kind of changes we're putting into motion are very long-lived. You know, when you think about it, it's difficult to melt something like Greenland to get its load of inertia in that system. So it takes a while, even with all the extra heat we've put to get. But once you start it going, as we now have, it's extremely difficult to slow it down, too. So we're committed to sea level rise of many feet, probably, at this point already.
And when they measure global warming, can you tell the listeners what they base that on? Because a lot of listeners, if they're in an area, for instance, in Kansas City, the last couple of years, especially this summer, was actually cooler.
Right.
And the winter was cooler.
Right. They don't just stand in one place and you know, stick their head out the window. They have, you know, our temperature record comes from many, many tens of thousands of sites all over the planet, and you average them and figure out what's going on.
So it's an average global temperature.
And so the average global temperature so far has gone up about a degree Celsius, or about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, 1.7. And that's a lot, but it's going to go up a lot more, 3 or 4 degrees Celsius, unless we get our act together very quickly.
I know. I attended a global warming conference once, and they compared it up in Goodstein.
Yes.
A facilitator.
Yes.
And they kind of compared it to if your child has a fever and they're running a 108-degree fever, you take action because it's alarming. So how do we get people to make the connection that it's the same situation when if the planet is running a fever?
Well, I think people are increasingly making that connection, and Mother Nature is a powerful educator. 85% of U.S. counties have had a federally declared disaster in the last 2 years. And so people are increasingly trying to take action. The problem in this case is that the richest industry in the world is in the way. The fossil fuel industry is our richest industry, and they're very resistant to change, and that's why we have to build movements strong enough to challenge their political power.
Let me ask you this. Is there some sign of change in the fossil fuel industry?
No, not within the industry itself, not yet. In fact, most of the big companies have sold off the small investments they made in sun and wind. They're making so much money in hydrocarbons right now that they're unwilling to change. In fact, they spend hundreds of millions of dollars lobbying to make sure that nothing ever changes in Washington so they can keep doing what they're doing.
One of the reasons I thought of that question, though, is that the concept of the climate, which you spoke at, there were three area utilities that actually co-sponsored, contributed to co-sponsoring that. So is that a sign?
There are some utilities that are beginning to understand that they don't have to be in hot to the fossil fuel industry all the time. And, you know, under some pressure from governments and things, they've begun to add wind and sun to their portfolios. And they're beginning to sense that it might be, that that might be useful. But the guys who sell coal and gas and oil, they want to keep selling coal and gas and oil.
Okay. The, a lot of the debate in the past I've heard, too, is that, okay, some people, some of the skeptics are coming around to acknowledging that there is global warming, but they still are trying to debate the issue, how much of it is caused by fossil fuels and how much is natural.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously what scientists have been interested in for a long time, and they basically concluded now, 20 years ago, that it's mostly caused by human beings. And, of course, that was what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reiterated again this past week.
And do you see, what do you see as happening in the political arena to deal with that?
Well, our big hope is that the biggest thing, immediate hope in the political arena is that President Obama will block the construction of this Keystone pipeline and become the first world leader to say, here's a big project we're not going to build because of its effect on the climate. And were that to happen, it would be a big deal. It would help reopen the international negotiations that have been stalled since the failed Copenhagen conference in 2009.
Is there, other than blocking the Keystone pipeline, what is he able to do realistically without the Republicans?
He's not able to do the things that we most need. We need most need a serious price on carbon, but that requires the cooperation of Congress, which clearly will not be forthcoming anytime soon.
And I saw, I guess it was yesterday, an article about the tar sands pipeline up in Alberta, and that it's been, they have a major problem with leaking, so the government up there has ordered them to, I guess, I don't know if I'm using the right word, to dredge the entire lake,
yes,
to drain it, to be able to clean it up.
Yeah, if you could see what was going on up in Alberta, it would make you sick. It is, I mean, there's a lot of examples of environmental devastation around the world, but none quite as grim as what's going on up there.
And if the Keystone Pipeline were to be built, that would carry the same type of tar sands from Alberta.
The same stuff.
Okay.
Dirtiest energy on Earth.
Now, a lot of people have been arguing for, they're saying that natural gas is not a good fuel to use, but better than coal as a bridge fuel until we develop enough of the wind and solar energy to basically take over everything that the coal is doing.
You know, we don't any longer have the time to do that. I mean, one of the problems of having written the first book about all this 25 years ago is that I have to stop myself from saying, if only you'd listened to me back then, you know. There were some things we could have done, but we're no longer in that place. We have to go quickly to renewable energy, and it's doable. I mean, the Germans, the one country that's really done this seriously, the Germans generated more than half the power they used some days this summer from the sun, and that's in Germany, which really isn't all that sunny.
Okay. How realistic is solar energy in the United States other than
well, I mean, you can do that in
area.
Germany, okay. Let's think what you might be able to do realistically in a country that had, oh, I don't know, Florida, Texas, California, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, Colorado, California, you know, the Great Plains. I mean, it would strike me that a fair amount of sunshine falls on our continent, so we might be okay. And we also, you know, on occasion, some wind blows across it, too. It's not for lack of resources. We could do this. It just would mean that guys who own coal mines wouldn't be making any money from it.
And for those who are interested or think that nuclear energy might work, of course, we had the enormous problem with the disposal, the waste disposal.
True.
That uses fossil fuels to produce the nuclear energy, is that correct?
Well, the nuclear energy doesn't produce that much in the way of carbon. I think the probably the thing that makes it unlikely to be a big part of the solution here is it's expensive. My guess is we're going to stay away from big centralized power production in the years ahead and move instead toward what the engineers call distributed generation. Much more like the millions of solar panels on millions of rooftops all interconnected.
What does the term distributed?
That's what it means. It means instead of a few big centralized power plants, dispersed.
Okay. And your new book, Oil and Honey, what is the theme or the major message?
It's just sort of talking about how we need to work both locally and globally. And we have to work in both areas or this isn't going to work.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to talk with you.
All right. Nice meeting you.
All right.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.